to the Western Mass Young Association. Some housekeeping things first.
Yeah.
There is an how many people are on the email list? Or no, don't answer that. If anybody isn't on the email list and you want to be get our email, there's an email list to sign up back in the back. And you can go to our programs on westmassyoung.org. And we ask for a $10 donation because we do have a lot of things we do have to pay for, so please help us keep the organization going if you can afford it and give us $10. So tonight, we don't take breaks, but if you need to go to the bathroom, if you go across the hall and through the doors, I think it says art shop across the door. Anyway, the double doors across the hall, and go to the end of that hall and take a left, you'll find some bathrooms. And we are recording this tonight, so if we're discussing and somebody has a question or something that you do not want to be recorded, just say, please stop the recording, and Chris will stop the recording. Okay, so another thing is, at the Boston Institute, they have an auditor program, which means that you don't have to be a candidate. You can start taking programs at the training institute, the seminar. And the application deadline for that is May 1st. So if you're interested in the auditor program, you can talk to me or Thayer Green, who will be standing up, or Penny Tarsuk, who will be standing up, and we'll be happy to talk to you about that program. So tonight, I'm Erica Lorenz, the president, and next month I won't be here because I have to go teach in Seattle. So I would like to do my favorite thing of the year to do. I'd like to thank my board by giving them a little gift. It's always fun. You don't know what's coming, do you? Okay, so first I'd like to thank Thayer Green, who's our analyst one of our analyst advisors. What shall I give him? Maybe I'll give him the hyacinth. Thank you, Thayer Green.
Thank you.
And Penny Tarsuk is also an analyst. Yes. And Judy Hall, who is our editor and
everything person.
And Dan, our webmaster. Thank you. And Charles will get the Gerber daisies. Where's Charles? Charles Williams, who's our historian. He's our historian, and he helped us start this whole thing along
Charles.
With there. Charles! Here's a
Charles.
Gift.
You
get a gift.
Peter.
Here's your gift. Thank you for being on the board. And Chris, who's our recorder. And I'm missing a flower. Oh dear, must be in my car. For Carol Beauvais, I'll give it to her afterwards. She's our community diva. Thank you. Okay. Penny is giving a dream workshop on April 23rd in room 107 in Sealy Hall.
Mike.
You still can't hear me? Okay. Penny Tarsuk, one of our local analysts, is giving a dream workshop on April 23rd from 9:30 to 12:30 in Sealy Hall, room 107. And you want to stand up and say a few words?
Good evening. I presented a talk on this in November, and it's on the archives if you want to review the talk itself, minus the dancing that we did beforehand, which was wonderful. It will be a workshop on the gift of psyche, imagination, and dream. And it will be 3 hours, and it's necessary to pre-register. So there's a sheet back there, or you can go on the website and also get my email and sign up if you wish. It'll be a limited group to 20, and I invite you all.
And $40
contribution. $40 contribution. We have to pay for the room, et cetera. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
And next month, we have our last lecture of the series, and it's The Female Hero from Ancient Myth to Modern Cinema. And she's using Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, The Homesman, Divergent, and Insurgent. Sarah Jackson from Great Barrington just talked here last year on art. Wonderful speaker. And so she'll be talking about the female hero. So tonight, after the talk, as usual, we have our salon at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street. So please come join us for a cup of tea and further discussion. Carol and I will be there, and maybe somebody else. So tonight we have John Yule from Boston, an analyst from Boston, and Thayer is going to introduce him on the topic of Jung in the 21st century. Thank you.
When I arrived in New England and connected with the Boston Institute after having been involved in the New York Jung Institute since 1967, one of the people that I came to know fairly quickly was John Huell. And I was impressed then. I become more impressed the longer I know John. He has written 8 books. He is by far the foundational Jungian scholar of New England Jungian thought and practice. And the more we have had a chance to connect, the more our individual journeys and connection with Jung have seemed to me to be parallel. So I look forward very much to his lecture tonight. He has been teaching at the Jung Institute over the last several years to the candidates, going through the whole collected works and talking about Jung in the 21st century. However, I share another equally important bond with John, and that is that we are both knowledgeable scholars and enormous advocates of the Boston Red Sox. So I now introduce you to John Huell.
Thank you very much, Thayer and Erica. I was asked to talk on the books that I most recently wrote, Jung in the 21st Century. The covers of the books look like this. I thought it was going to be one book, but the publisher insisted that it was two. And it divides quite nicely. The far one you see over there is Volume 1, Evolution and Archetype. And you probably notice there's an insect on that thing. And that is a yucca moth. The yucca moth is Jung's favorite example to describe what an archetype is. And what I have tried to do in that book is to show you that the ideas that Jung came up with 100 years ago have actually been discovered to be in harmony with what we today know about science, about the biology and the psychology of us humans. And so the theory of the archetypes, therefore, is crucial. even though it has been the thing that most people who believe Jung is some sort of a mystic and out of touch with everything real had missed. It really does work. And so the first volume was an attempt to show how much Jung is in harmony with the science that has developed since he died. And the second volume addresses Jung's critique of science, because he thought that scientists too much were afraid to venture into areas that were controversial. Jung was particularly interested in what he eventually called synchronicity. And synchronicity is frequently declared by scientists to be impossible and therefore doesn't deserve study. Jung's point of view would be, it happens all the time. We just need to know what's going on here. And so, and he had made an attempt to do that, and so that's what I try to show in Volume 2. Volume 2 has to do mostly with Jung and physical science, and Volume 1 has mostly to do with Jung and biological science. Now, I'm trying to argue there that Jung is something of a scientist. And that's a point of view that was almost universally believed to be impossible a few decades ago. During his entire career, Jung was dealing with what is now called the standard social science model. It has a number of assumptions. Jung, by the way, called it psychology without the psyche. And you can see why. Animals have instincts, and therefore you can study the biology of animals and the instincts that they have and so forth. But humans don't have instincts. We are much higher than that. We don't have any instincts. What we have is culture. And we gradually learn our culture over the course of life. So we are born, the standard social science model says, with a mind that is a blank slate. Animals are not born with a blank slate. They have instincts. We have to learn everything, and there's a tremendous advantage in learning everything, and that also separates us from the animals. It separates us from the world, in fact. And then finally, research was done on the stimulus response model. You didn't have to know anything about a psyche. All you had to do was give a person a stimulus and see what response he came up with. You could ignore the psyche, which is why Jung called this psychology without the psyche. So that made it seem as though all of those people who said Jung is nothing but a mystic who's come up with a theory of the archetypes, which are impossible, they're mystical ideas. And usually when they said these things, they thought that Jung was saying that we inherit images. Jung did not say that. Jung said that we inherit the capabilities for certain human behaviors, just as animals do, and that we have instincts, just as animals do. Anyway, it was about 1998. When I went to a meeting in which I was surprised to find everybody talking about evolutionary psychology. I'd never heard about it before. But, and here are the founders of evolutionary psychology, by the way, a husband and wife team, a psychologist, Leda Cosmides, and an anthropologist, John Tooby. And they came up with the idea that human beings must be like the animals. We must have inherited something too. And so that led me to, that's when I began working on the idea of Jung in the 21st century. And the germinal insight of Jung in the 21st century, which I call J21, is that Jung fought the psychology of his day that he called psychology without the psyche, and now suddenly, psychology wants to root itself in evolution. These people know nothing about Jung. They're coming forward with Jungian ideas for which they're developing their own words. For example, they talk not about archetypes, but of mental modules that we have inherited from our ancestors. So I thought, if these people only knew that Jung had gotten there beforehand, that might be a useful thing for them and us. Because, to tell you the truth, Probably the biggest reason I took on the writing of this book was I was afraid that Jung would be remembered only as the guru of the New Age and never as somebody who substantially contributed to our understanding of who we are. So, evolutionary psychology catches up with Jung. It locates humanity within evolution, that is, within the cosmos, and locates psyche both within the body and within the cosmos. And that's what I would like to talk about today. It spells the end of Descartes' mind-body problem and finally justifies Jung's collective unconscious. So that's that's what evolutionary psychology got me going on. I finally decided that many of the evolutionary psychologists are not very dependable, and it was better to read biologists on the topics of evolution rather than evolutionary psychologists. This is how I started out. What I'd like to talk about now is the fact that the more I talk about this book, the more I see it differently. And it reminds me of what Jung said about his monumental book that's now called Symbols of Transformation. It was the book that he wrote that brought about his break from Freud. Because he began talking about archetypes, and because he liberated libido from sexual energy and called it intentionality in general. These things were not acceptable to Freud, and it led to the breakup between them. But in the, I think it was the second preface to the Symbols of Transformation, Jung said that shortly after he finished the book, he realized what it was about. And he said what it was about was that each one of us is living a myth, whether we know it or not. And we'd be better off knowing what the myth is than not knowing the myth. He added that he regretted to say that he didn't know what his own myth was. And if you follow the things that Jung says about his own myth, he went for another good 12 or 13 years before he discovered his own myth. So I'm saying something like that. I'm saying that I wrote this book trying to say, hey, look, Jung was a scientist at heart. And not only that, he criticized other scientists for not going far enough. That's what I thought I was saying. But now I suddenly realize Jung has presented us with a far more integrated view of things than I had imagined. The heart of what I'd like to say tonight is that Jung is really arguing for a microcosmic, macrocosmic point of view. If you know Jung at all, you may know that he sometimes says that the center of our personality, the wholeness of our personality, is what he calls the self. And one of the most frequent examples he gives for the self is the Hindu idea of Atman. The Upanishads talk about us finding out our real identity, and our real identity is our Atman, which might be called our soul or our self. And Jung says, and we are also Atman with a capital A. And I think what he means by that is what the Upanishads say when they say, thou art that, they mean not only are you Atman, self, but you are Brahman, who is the self of the universe. Atman and Brahman are the same. And I think that's exactly what Jung has been saying with his collected works all taken together. And I'd like to make an argument for that tonight. And as I go along, I invite you to interrupt with questions if you like. If I don't get through all the slides, that'll be okay, because I find that questions usually are more useful than my just rambling on forever. Anyway, so the central metaphor then it comes from alchemy, and I'm quoting Marianne Atwood, who is the figure that Jung said was the only female alchemist who actually wrote anything. And he said, in fact, you can still get her book, although her father insisted that it be destroyed when it was written because it had revealed all the secrets of alchemy. Jung said he read the book because it still is available. You can buy it through Amazon if you like. It's entitled Inquiring into the Hermetic Mystery, I believe. Something of that nature. Anyway, she says, our microcosmic, that is, biological life, brings us into contact with the macrocosm. And I think that is the insight that I didn't know I was getting when I was writing Jung in the 21st century. So, I would like to start by talking about what archetypes are. Because as I began to talk about the book, I began to realize, boy, I really brought Jung right down into the heart of biology here. And I was almost a little shocked to see it. The archetype is the instinct's power. So you've got to have instincts in order to have archetypes. They're part of the same structure, really. The instinct's power to recognize a signal, and act out a typical behavior pattern. Jung also says the archetype is the self-portrait of the instinct. So, here we have our yucca moth again on the slide. And here is a picture of the yucca moth on a yucca flower, and there's a yucca plant in bloom over there. And what Jung says is, the yucca moth spends most of its life as a caterpillar, doing nothing but eating. It never has any idea at all about flowers, or about sex, or about propagation. When it spins a cocoon, transforms into a moth, and comes fluttering out, it may still not know any of these things, but as soon as it encounters a blooming yucca plant, it knows exactly what to do. It carries out a very complicated reproductive strategy that it could never have learned. Its life as a moth is very, very brief, and it has no chance to learn from other moths how to do it. And that's the point. The point is that built into the archetype is the whole structure of the behavior. And something comes along, the archetypal image, which for the yucca moth is the blooming yucca plant. No doubt the smell and sight of the yucca flower in bloom excites something in the moth so that it's compelled, eager to carry out the path of reproduction that involves the bloom and its own efforts. And more examples can be found in Jung. For example, he says about the weaver bird and its nest. He says it's more probable that a young weaver bird builds its characteristic nest because he is a weaver bird and not a rabbit. Similarly, it is more probable that man is born with a specific human mode of behavior and not with that of a hippopotamus. Or with none at all. So clearly what he's saying when he says and or with none at all, he's attacking those standard social science people who said that humans are all born with a tabula rasa, an empty slate for a mind. If you didn't get the picture of the nest well, this is a typical weaver bird nest, and you can see it's quite different from other birds' nests. Here is another archetypal image. In this case, it is a baboon in estrus. And the male baboon, seeing and smelling the evidence of the swelling on the female baboon, immediately gets as excited as the yucca moth did when it encountered the flowering yucca plant. And if we were to think about human beings, we might come up with images such as this, which again are archetypal images which have to do with a whole, now we're talking about humans, a whole variety of activities that could take place. The one on the left suggests something ritualistic, something mystical. The one on the right, well, could be mystical, could be something else, But clearly, the birth of Venus is one of the most important archetypal images for human sexuality. Humans can do more when they encounter an archetypal image. They have a whole variety of things they can do. The yucca moth has only one thing that it can do. So anyway, this is the idea behind an archetype. So here are some remarks about from Jung that relate to this. He says, the end of alchemy, and he gives the date, rough date of about 1650, represents a great schism. A tremendous dividing took place. And what he's saying there is the alchemists worked in a mythological world. Everything they were doing in their laboratories had a mythological meaning as well as an empirical meaning. So they were working as sort of mythic scientists. When we moved out of the alchemical world into the world of modern science, we left behind the mythic. And Jung is saying, we lost something tremendous when we left behind the mythic. And so that's why he says this a great schism has occurred, and his Jung's goal, I think, or what he would like most like to have been able to effect or to encourage would be our finding. By our, he means the people of the West for the most part. Our finding a mythological way to live, because the way we're living right now is fairly empty. There are huge numbers of people in crisis over the issues of meaning in their lives. There's no meaning built into the lives we are living for the most part. Since the end of alchemy, this is not something that's a given that everybody learns. He also, what I found when I read his first couple of lectures that he gave at the Aranos conferences, and this would be in 1934 and 5 and 6. Aranos was a conference that took place every summer at the villa of one of Jung's supporters on Lago Maggiore in the Italian part of Switzerland, and scholars would come from all over the world to talk about their most recent research, research they hadn't gotten around to publishing yet, or might not ever publish because they still hadn't worked it out enough. So that's where Jung was presenting his first studies on alchemy, and I found a very excited C.G. Jung in those lectures. And one of the things that he was most excited about was that the alchemists were working with substances that were as much spiritual as they were material. And what he's saying about the modern world is, for us, matter is dead. For them, matter was already divine. And I think Jung really picked up that picture, that there's something in matter that's at least mental, if not divine, at least psychic, if not divine. In fact, I think it's divine. So that's this piece of Jung was his response to, and also the reason for his mourning over the great schism when science separated itself from mythology. So he comes to the view that nothing is only material. And I'd say that we could say that the distinction between instinct and archetype, which really are they're the same entity, really. I would say that archetype are sort of the eyes, nose, and ears of the instinct, because it's the archetype that recognizes the archetypal image that gets the individual moving in a certain direction. So we could say instinct is more like matter, archetype more like spirit, which brings us to another fundamental view of Jung's. He says, he locates, this whole bar all the way across is the electromagnetic spectrum. Right here is the part of the spectrum that we can see as colors. But beyond that, you've got the ultraviolet, which we can't see, and the infrared, which we also can't see. So Psyche occurs in the colored area. Because in Jung's view, Psyche is, you know you have Psyche when it talks to itself in images. So humans, we know, have a Psyche. We can say dogs have a Psyche. Clearly they dream. Cats have a Psyche. Probably squirrels have psyches. Possibly lobsters don't have psyches. One of the biologists, prominent biologists that I have cited in this book, would say that, well, when you get down to lobsters, I think probably not. But the whole thing is whether it talks to itself in images. We could imagine for sure that the yucca moth doesn't talk to itself in images. It simply encounters a blooming yucca plant or not. But there's something psychological going on in the yucca moth anyway. Here's another quote from Jung. Well, close to a quote. I'm going to recite it off the top of my head. At one place in volume 8 of the collected works, he says, theoretically, you could peel back the collective unconscious like the leaves of an onion. And the outside leaves would be then the archetypes of humans. Under that, we would have maybe primate archetypes. Under that, generally mammalian archetypes. And you could go all the way down to the psychology of a worm or even an amoeba. So if a worm or an amoeba has a psyche, something very psyche-like is going on in them. They don't talk to themselves in images, as far as we know, but way over there in the dark area on the left of the screen in the infrared is the physiological psychoid. Jung uses the word psychoid to mean psyche-like. It is not a noun, it is an adjective. So the psychological psychoid portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, we could say, that we're using as a metaphor here, that would be where the instinct resides. And the spiritual psychoid over here, which also doesn't talk to us in images, but may give us elated feelings of union with God or something like that, that would be the spiritual psychoid. That would be the part where the archetype plays its role. So that metaphor, I think, is very useful, because as soon as you say that, then all of life is psychoid. And we have that in common. The thing that's different from us and a tree or a yucca moth would be that we can talk to ourselves about what we're experiencing in images and words and so forth. These other ones can't do that. Their mental capacity isn't as well developed as ours. Their psychic capacity isn't as well as developed as ours. But they're our kin. You could say down there in that onion that Jung's imagining when he peels it back, the center of it is a single-celled being like an amoeba. And as evolution took place and animals got more and more complicated, so also did their psychoid process. Until finally we have animals who actually have psyches. So archetypes are therefore embedded in evolution. And I would like to show you some mother-infant interactions that show parallels between human infants and their development and the evolutionary advance through the primate line. And for to do that, I'm going to cite these two guys here. Stanley Greenspan, a psychiatrist, and Stuart Shanker, a philosopher, who wrote a big fat book called The First Idea, published in 2004. And I'm only referring to, he goes through the whole of our life style, our human life span, I guess you could say, and all of the changes that take place in the thing. But I was only interested to tell you about this part, where the human infant and primate infants of various species have a lot in common. So at the beginning, we have the human baby at 1 month. And we know that a newly born baby is prone to violent emotional outbursts, and that needs to be soothed, held, soothed, and brought into harmony with mom. And for that, we have a limbic system, which picks up at an unconscious emotional level what is going on in the face and in the bodily gestures of another person. And so the baby and the mother are gazing at one another, making expressions, facial expressions to one another, cooing toward one another in ways that are relating at an emotional level. So the interaction includes looking, listening, calming the baby, directing the baby's awareness to the other world, and this is the same thing that goes on with a marmoset mother and baby. A marmoset being one of the most primitive and earliest forms of primate. The marmosets don't go beyond this first stage, but monkeys like the rhesus monkey do. In the second stage, human baby at 3 months over there, they call a period of engagement and relating, and they mean now the baby and the mother are experiencing pleasure in relating, and they have feelings of intimacy. And this has gone well beyond merely calming the baby down, and we find the same abilities in the rhesus monkey and other similar monkeys. Going on, the human baby at 6 months, now the interaction it contains some real intentional signaling. The baby and mother are reading and responding to the emotional signals one is giving the other. It even brings about cause and effect thinking, in the sense that the child now gets the idea, if I make such and such a move, mom will do such and such. So it begin to get an idea of how I can get mom to do certain things for me by my doing certain things. Baboon babies learn that. And the rhesus monkey babies do not. So what we see here is our infant development recapitulating the development of the primate line. Next stage, the human baby at 1 year compares well to the chimp baby at the end of its development with its mother on this particular train. Social problem solving marks the start of the pre-symbolic self. And so they're saying that the human baby at 1 year and the chimp baby and mother. They've done a lot of research, a lot of personal observing of primates as well as babies in order to put this whole thing together. Finally, the last stage is the human child at 2 years, where experiences are put into words, playing, drawing, other symbolic forms of expression are going on between mother and baby. And they compare that to the archaic Homo sapiens. That would be our earliest ancestors, human ancestors, between 60,000 and 600,000 years ago. Now that's pure speculation. They couldn't observe them. But what they did note is what the shapes of their brains must have been on the basis of skulls that have been discovered by archaeologists. And so you can see that certain developments on the brain, because there'll be openings or widening spots on this bone that make provision for this development in the brain. Anyway, that is the argument, and what this shows is that we are deeply biological beings. Everything about our growth and everything else is presaged in the life of the primates that preceded us. And so Jung's theory of the archetypes is deeply embedded in reality, in the material reality of who we are. It's hardly a mystical idea, even though it has mystical applications. So, I'd like to pause for a moment and consider what an archetype is. in order to fit what we've just been seeing. First of all, an archetype is a species universal pattern. That means the pattern will be found in every member of the species. It's a pattern of meaningful recognition. I've indicated before, the yucca moth, for example, recognizes the flowering yucca plant as the thing that he really needs to attend to at that particular point in his life's course. It's also, we could also put, it's more than that though, because sometimes in the middle of a dream, human replacements for the yucca flower may appear. That is to say, an extremely interesting person that I might be romantically interested can appear. In which case, you could say that the archetype is steering me in my dream to come up with the kinds of experiences that belong to social encounters of that kind. So what I'm saying is, it's not only a matter of recognition, it's also a matter of imaginal projection also is where the also involves the archetype. So it's a pattern. Also, we could also say about that pattern, it's a pattern that resembles behaviors in closely related species, as we just saw in the comparison of the babies and the primates. And that allows us to trace a hypothetical line of inheritance back to an ancestor species, possibly an extinct ancestor species. You know, it's frequently said, for example, that probably we come from an ancestor that whose descendants divided into chimpanzees on the one side and humans on the other. The line that moved toward us is one line. The move toward chimpanzees went in the other direction. That extinct species no longer exists. We don't know what it's like, but it's kind of like a mix between a chimpanzee and a human. So it's the arousal of an archetype entails identifiable physiological alterations. For example, brain tracks. Certain brain tracks are involved with each different archetype. Certain hormones are released with each different archetype. And as a result, archetypes produce emotional and even numinous experiences. Excuse me. So I wanted to make it clear that the whole thing about archetypes keeps us locked into what really goes on in the lives of human beings, their lives as beings that belong to the entire evolutionary structure that we see that is evident on the face of the earth. So, I'm saying that Jung is locating what is human in a biological evolutionary context. And why that's important is not only that we are animals, we are evolved, we do belong to this whole process, but this makes us a part of nature. We could say, and this is where I want to go next, we are the microcosm. We belong to the macrocosm. In fact, we are the consciousness of the cosmos, is the argument that not only am I making, but Jung says that himself. You know, that the idea of the as above, so below, and that we are a microcosm which mirrors in its essential structure the structure of the cosmos, those were essential ideas of the alchemists that Jung spent some 20 or 30 years studying. And I think the reason that he dove in so energetically was he felt that the alchemists were in touch with something that we have lost and we need to get back to it. And he was Well, maybe what I should say is, what was Jung's myth when he finally discovered it? In 1925, he gave a seminar to his followers in Zurich, and he talked about his latest experience. First of all, he gave all of the experiences he had had, which led to his psychology of archetypes. That he was building on his own experience in coming up with these things. And he did come to the point of view that we're all living a myth, whether we know it or not, and we ought to know what it is. And he, at the time that he gave the seminar in the summer of 1925, he still didn't know what his myth was. But he did tell of a near experience, you could say. He had been in New Mexico with the Pueblo Indians, sitting on the roof of one of their buildings, talking to the chief, whose name was Mountain Lake. And Mountain Lake pointed to the sun and said, "Isn't that God?" And Jung said, "Well, I don't know. Could it be a ball of fire that God created?" "Oh no, that is God. And we Pueblo people are responsible for that sun rising every day. Our rituals help the sun to rise every day, and we do it for the entire earth. The Americans want us to stop doing it. They've outlawed our rituals. They don't know what they're trying to do. How can they be so stupid? We're doing this for the entire earth." And Jung said, "I suddenly realized the great dignity that manifested in the way these people walked and talked. These people are the sons of the sun. I wish I had a myth like that. That's exactly the kind of thing I'm looking for." And it was about 6 months later, he was in Africa, and he climbed up to the top of a fairly low hill, I guess, and looked down into a valley where thousands of herd animals were slowly moving through. And he, as he looked upon that, he said, "That's the way it would be. All of that would go on in darkness. All of that walking, all of that munching, all of that giving in birth, all of that dying would have gone on in darkness unless someone like me was here on the top of the hill seeing it and knowing that it's the world." And so what he was saying is, each one of us humans brings consciousness to the world which it wouldn't have if it didn't have us. So that was Jung's myth, and he expressed it in many ways in the course of his life and in the course of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, his quasi-autobiography. All right, some more remarks of Jung that support this journey I'm trying to take you on here. Theoretically, the collective unconscious could be peeled like an onion down to the psychology of an amoeba. I jumped ahead on that one. And an amoeba doesn't have a psyche, but demonstrates psychoid, that is, psyche-like process. All right, I did want to remind you of that anyway, as we start moving into the second half of the thesis. And the second half of the thesis has to do with that second volume, Synchronicity. Sometimes on the slides, I may abbreviate synchronicity with a capital letter sigma, because that's how Jung wrote in his notebooks. He abbreviated synchronicity with a capital sigma. So he attempts to expand our Western conception of reality in his doctrine of synchronicity to include forgotten powers of the soul. And there are two very powerful examples that he gives. One of them comes from his autobiography again, Memories, Dreams, and Reflection. That's the suicide incident. Jung was away from Zurich, staying in a hotel room, probably participating at a conference of some kind. And about 2 a.m, he was awakened in a terrible depression. And he recognized that this was a distinctive depression. This was the depression of one of his patients. He felt he was feeling the depression of his patient hundreds of miles away in another city. And then he felt what he said, "something passing through my head like a bullet." And when he woke up in the morning, there was a telegram for him at breakfast telling him that his patient had committed suicide at about 2 o'clock the night before by shooting himself with a pistol. So somehow or other, over that distance, the distance didn't matter. Because he was so connected emotionally to that guy who killed himself, he was able to be affected by it, even to recognize the style of depression as the depression of that particular person. And the other one, so this is synchronicity as something that involves two different psyches experiencing the same thing at more or less the same time. Another one is described by the most prominent example he gives in the article on synchronicity, what we call the scarab incident. Jung was working with a woman who could not believe that the unconscious existed. He said she was a Cartesian philosopher, as a follower of René Descartes, to whom we owe lots of things, and some of them we sort of regret having, such as the mind-body split, which goes back to René Descartes. Anyway, she couldn't accept the unconscious, so she was getting nowhere in her analysis, and this particular day she told Jung that she dreamt that someone had handed her a golden scarab. And at that moment, Jung heard a tapping at the window in his office. He opened the window, and in flew a bug he grabbed with his hand, and he looked at it. It was a rose chafer, which is, he said, the closest kin to the scarab beetle in Northern Europe. And he handed her the rose chafer and said, "Here is your scarab." And that was a significant event, because now she had to realize there were things that happened that she couldn't explain, and maybe even she might have an unconscious. And so from then on, Jung said, the analysis proceeded. There are people who have written about synchronicity who say, it's only about psychology, folks. Don't get the world involved in this. It's so anti-scientific that there can't ever be an answer for it. My friend Victor Mansfield, who was an astrophysicist, wrote a very, very nice book on synchronicity, but he says don't take it out of the psychological realm, because it impacted his science too much. He couldn't say okay to synchronicity unless it was merely a psychological thing. But here's a diagram that Jung actually put in his article on synchronicity. I'm referring up here to what's written in black. Jung, as you probably know, loved to describe things in terms of what he called quaternities, two pairs of opposites at 90 degrees to one another. So what I did by putting those blue lines in there, he said, Newtonian science accepts these three, space, time, and causality. And Jung is saying, all right, that's not enough to describe the cosmos. You got to have something else. It's synchronicity. This is the thing that science has overlooked. Now, you know, when Jung was working on synchronicity, he was describing all of his work to Wolfgang Pauli, one of the founders of quantum mechanics. And Wolfgang Pauli said, no physicist would ever separate space and time. And what he means by that is, Einstein taught us that we don't understand the cosmos unless we understand that space-time itself is an entity. Space-time, in fact, describes how gravity works. Space-time you can think of as a rubber sheet, where every planet and every star has enough mass to indent it, and which causes the other ones that are nearby to start rolling toward it. That's gravity. Newton came up with gravity, of course, and knew how to describe it mathematically. The only trouble was, it seemed to be action at a distance. And how can that be possible? This is a mystical idea. He called it Eros, in his notebooks that some force like Eros is working to attract the planets to one another. So Einstein came up with something significant. The way that you can come up with a metaphor for understanding how gravity works. So it's very clear that Vatz diagrams being in the synchronicity article means that Jung intended to say synchronicity is a cosmic phenomenon. In fact, with synchronicity, we always have action at a distance. And that's why science doesn't want to accept it. How can it be that Jung's mind and his patient's mind were doing the same thing at the same moment? How can it be that Rose Chafer wanted to get into the office just at the moment that the golden scarab was being talked about? So, I have proposed an alternative to Jung's quaternity, and I think it works pretty well. And now, instead of talking about ideas, I'm talking about fields, which is, you know, what scientists really talk a lot about these days. And this horizontal line here is the world of Newtonian physics, the old physics, not the new physics. Actually, it also includes Einstein. Relativity is also involved in this because space-time, just look at the horizontal line, we have the common sense world that we live in. So the common sense world is characterized by causality and locality. That is to say, think of it this way, when two balls on a pool table encounter one another, one is running forward, the other one's perhaps just sitting there, it bumps it and moves the other ball in a certain direction. And we can work out the mathematics of that causality. Two things were in the same place at the same time, and one caused something to happen to the other. So that's what that horizontal line has. Gravity we can now understand that way since Einstein. And at the other end are the electromagnetic field, which describes how light moves, how electrons move, all that sort of thing. Also, a very causal description. The y-axis, on the other hand, is acausal, like Jung's idea of synchronicity, an acausal connecting principle, he called it. So the y-axis is acausal and non-local. Things are happening at a distance all the time. And so at the top is Q and the bottom sigma. The Q stands for the quantum world, which is sometimes described as the chaotic quantum sea. That is to say, all of these subatomic particles, if they are particles, because sometimes they're waves, some of them are almost always waves and never particles. I mean, this is a very confusing situation. You can't know everything about any particle. You can only know some things about a particle, and only for an instant that's passed already. And everything that we do, every experiment that we work on them, we have influenced what happens with the particles. So here's a world in which the subject-object dichotomy is gone. Not the subject and object are implicated in everything. No doubt that was one of the things Jung liked about quantum mechanics, because the same thing happens in synchronicity. So what I would say is this: in the chaotic quantum field of particle fields in quantum mechanics, it seems as though things are happening for no good reason. It's happening because that's just what happens. And you can't work out a causality. You can't make a prediction. All you can say is it's more likely that a certain particle than another will appear at a certain moment. But you don't know that. It's all worked out by probabilities. The bottom one now would be the one that's called with a sigma. Jung proposes a psychoid field to the universe. Remember how psychoid came into this discussion in the first place. It's all of those animals who don't have a psyche yet, because they are more primitive and their psyches don't talk to themselves in images, are described as having psychoid process. And a lot of what goes on in us has psychoid process. All of the strange feelings that we have that we can't figure out why they happen, those depressions that are puzzling to us and so forth, all of those things are happening at a physiological level and not rising sufficiently into our psyche that we can figure out what's going on. They also are psychoid process. So, and you know, one of the most important things about quantum mechanics also is that non-locality appears frequently. That is to say, for instance, two electrons or two photons involved in the same chemical reaction can be as far apart as the universe is wide, and they still keep changing in harmony with one another. At the same time that one changes, the other changes, as though they are twins. And that's another thing that's very much like synchronicity. So, anyway, my four universal fields hypothesis is an attempt to articulate what Jung, I think, was trying to say in words that, in a way that I can do now that he couldn't do in 1960, you know, the year before he died, because he didn't have enough information about that. So, that brings us to macrocosm and microcosm. Synchronicity is possible because the universe itself is governed by a psychoid principle. That means that the universe itself is something like an organism, that it's organized that way, that the smaller parts influence the bigger parts, the bigger parts have an influence on the smaller parts. Everything works together as a unit. And in talking about synchronicity, Jung admits that our metaphysics, he doesn't call it metaphysics, but that's what he really means. That is to say, the way we assume things have to be in order for our theories to be correct. Our assumptions in the West are purely materialistic, and matter is dead, and these things can't happen. And Jung is saying, we have to get out of this metaphysics. And surprisingly, we're pretty much the only culture that has ever come up with such a crazy idea. And he cites a whole bunch of different cultures and points of view that have done so. That's why I brought in at the bottom the anima mundi, the soul of the world that the alchemists talked about so much, or the Tao, that is such a central idea in Chinese philosophy and mysticism. So anyway, and here I also want to bring in some more remarks of Jung that apply to this whole thing. Jung says this in two or three different ways, and since I just came upon the hadith of Muhammad saying it, that's what I put in here, but I think it's also in a slightly different form in the Quran. Anyway, God says, I was a hidden treasure, and I wanted to be known, so I created the world. Jung is talking about that in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, page 339, when he says, if the Creator were conscious of himself, he would not need conscious creatures. Nor is it probable that the extremely indirect methods of creation, which squander millions of years upon the development of countless species and creatures, are the outcome of purposeful intention. Right there, he blows the intelligent design people out of the water, long before they even appeared. He's saying, you know, the intelligent design people are talking about images like this, where God stands outside the world and drafts all of its angles and all of its distances and works out all the laws that physics is going to discover and begins the process, at least, of evolution. And Jung is saying, well, you know, if God were such an intelligent designer, why would he have let it go on for something like 14 billion years to get to the space it is now? We've got all these creatures that came into existence and became extinct over all this time. And it took all this time to arrive at intelligent beings like ourselves. And presumably, God may even want more, a higher intelligence than ours, if he wants to know who he really is. So the cosmos is reflecting back to God who he is. But I'm suggesting that God, in Jung's view, God does not stand outside the cosmos. God is somehow inbuilt in the cosmos, very much like the Anima Mundi, or like Shiva, who I would say that the Hindu mythology of Shiva comes closer to Jung's view, namely that the universe was danced into being by Shiva, that everything in the universe is comprised of Shiva consciousness. We are ourselves comprised of Shiva consciousness, and while we love our consciousness very much and like to think of ourselves as separate, we sort of, in our minds, we kind of think of ourselves as little buds off the universe who have our own individuality. And yeah, we have a certain individuality, but we're missing the big point. We are the cosmos. And to find and to realize that we are the cosmos and that we are Shiva is precisely why, I believe, Jung says, Atman with a capital A, that thou art that also. Here are a couple of images of the Anima Mundi, the soul of the world. That one from one of the alchemical books of the Middle Ages, and this one, a more recent one, that I just happened to find on the internet. You can see that what's going on there is a living reality is being proposed for the macrocosm. So, Jung's psychoid field. Remember, he said that in synchronicity is made possible by a psychoid field. So think about the human psyche or self. It harmonizes all the organs and tissues of the body, as well as all the thoughts and everything else. Whereas the psyche or self, whether it's the psyche of the microcosm or the psychic process of the macrocosm, it governs everywhere, but is nowhere to be found as an entity. It manifests itself everywhere. Even the universe has a soul, the Anima Mundi. And should we not call it God? I think Jung does essentially call it God when he says, if the Creator were conscious of himself, he would not need conscious creatures. Nor is it probable that the extremely indirect methods of creation, which squander millions of years on the development of countless species and creatures, are the outcome of purposeful intention. All right, that's my argument for the day, and I noticed that I wasn't interrupted too many times in the course of this, but by all means, ask questions now. Yes?
What about the idea that possibly humans have come to a point where they are creating their own extinction?
Their own extinction?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's the least bit in contradiction to this. We aren't paying much attention. I think one of the this point of view that we and the macrocosm are of the same nature ought to make us respectful of the cosmos in a way that we are not now. We have the idea that in having the idea that matter is dead, we can do anything with it we want. It's here for us to use as we wish. And that's what's causing our extinction, I would say. I would say we are on the verge of extinction if global warming continues. And many societies have gone into extinction because they used up all the trees or all the water or all of the nutrients in the soil or something like that. So we have many examples before us of people who stupidly, I guess we could say, didn't realize how much they depended on the world around them and how respectful they should have been about it. So I would say that species going extinct is part of evolution. And it's part of the whole picture. And while I presented this kind of as Jung did, that we human beings are the consciousness that reflects back to God who he is in the highest possible way, There may be intelligent beings on other planets in the cosmos, since there are so many planets, and they may, some of those may be way ahead of us. And they may even figure out how not to globally warm their worlds or whatever. There?
I have two, examples or... examples. One is Jung's book, Answer to Job, because it strikes me that he's wrestling with many of the same issues in a somewhat different cultural context and religious context that you are describing here. And he sees the reaction of Yahweh or of God to Job's confrontation with him or her as at first outrageous. He's going to call upon Leviathan or whatever to shut Job up.
Mm-hmm.
But Job won't shut up. And the result of that, as I understand it, then comes to realize is God realizes that he has to become incarnate in human life and in the world in order to have a bridge of consciousness so that God's consciousness can be connected with our worldly human experience. Is that...
I agree. I think that's exactly what he's saying in Answer to Job. And I think that fairly well fits this picture of needing us to reflect back to him who he was, because, you know, as he says, Job is more conscious than God is here.
Yeah.
Job knows that this is an injustice has been done. God doesn't seem to know it. He's only interested in his power. And that's why Jung says at the beginning, he says that there's a beware to the reader where he says, I'm really going to get carried away here. I want you to know this, that in advance, because he's really angry about that whole picture.
Right.
Yeah, yes.
My other example is the I Ching. Jung wrote the introduction to Wilhelm's classic interpretation of the I Ching. And in that, he educates us on the principle of synchronicity.
Yes.
And I use the I Ching in my work with clients very frequently, particularly when the client and I come up against a real dilemma, a real not knowing. And I say, I think we have to call upon the wisdom of the universe and see what guidance we can receive. And I won't say I've had 100% response, partly because I'm not always sure how to interpret the response, especially in the Wilhelm translation. But
No, I agree with you. I also use the I Ching in a similar way, and usually I let the patient do most of the work. I kind of set it up for them by saying, what do you think about this situation here? And it seems to me that the analysand who threw the coins to generate the hexagram is seeing a tremendous application to those very impersonal images in the I Ching to his own or her own life. It's very striking to me how well they receive that. And you're right, it's using this same microcosm, macrocosm metaphor to achieve that. All right, other, yes?
Well, you know, I've read a lot of Edinger's work on the Answer to Job and his elaboration, and you know, I think that a main point in Answer to Job is that Job is saying it's not my fault,
I don't deserve this treatment.
Right. So, you know, when I see the polarization that goes on in civilization, you know, and particularly this huge rise in consciousness, at the same time, you know, rise of Trump, etc. It's interesting to see that, you know, it's like the dark side of God and this, you know, profound intuition that the deepest thing is eros and love and knowing with, so both logos and eros together, and that it seems like it's left to, like, you know, as the alchemists would say, our complete nature, it seems like it's left to this, you know, human possibility of accessing love to bring in relationship to power or the monstrous, you know, instead of, you know, kind of stopping at the righteousness that progressives often do. And, you know, so you know, it elevates it over the personal level. Like, you know,
right. So I'm trying to get a handle on what you're saying, though. Are you disagreeing with Jung, or saying that Jung's argument is too narrowly personal? I'm trying to get a handle on what you're saying.
I think it gives. I guess it's, you know, the myth is of human meaning. Is that God both wants to become conscious and resist becoming conscious. I mean, this is really from Edinger's Creation of Consciousness that he's, you know, that I've studied, and it just feels so congruent with what one was saying, but just...
Right, and Thayer did say that this was God's realization that he needed to become human in order to know something that Job already knew. I think that was the point there, and that was something that reflected the view that Jung says that if the creator were conscious of himself, he would not need conscious creatures. So Thayer was picking up on that and saying, and here's an example of where Jung works with that. That whole image when God and Job confront one another. Yes?
Can you talk a little more, if you can, about the way in which on your diagram you had synchronicity at the bottom and quantum, the chaotic quantum sea at the top, you know, along the...
Yes.
Why do you feel that they're separate? I mean, why are they on opposite ends, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out.
They're on opposite ends, I think, because quantum mechanics is puzzlingly unclear. It may be the case that, I mean, there have been some people working in that field, David Bohm, for example, who have tried to develop theories that would account for certain facts, but they themselves were not ever satisfied that they'd come up with something. They run into the problem that we really don't know what's going on here, and it doesn't seem to make any sense. And yet, the mathematics we worked out to describe it is the best mathematics we ever had. So there they are, figuring they've got something real, and yet scratching their heads and asking what it is. So it's the confusing and chaotic quality at the top. At the bottom, there's the organization that everything has a tendency to organize into psychoid structures. Now, for example, there are organic molecules in outer space. We don't know how they got there. The space stations... I don't remember the exact numbers, but it seems like in 14 years of space stations, something like 140 microorganisms evolved. Mm-hmm. Those microorganisms, which originally came in on the bodies and on the equipment that the astronauts had, they've evolved so that now they're eating the glass and the steel and the insulation on the wires of the space vehicle. So put living matter someplace where it doesn't have something to eat, and it will evolve to eat what's there, seems to be what's coming out. Anyway, so the point is, we think that evolution has to proceed very, very, very slowly. And it seems as though it doesn't. It moves a lot faster than we think. So those kinds of things suggest to me that the psychoid principle is that something like the psychoid principle is functioning. In fact, there's a chapter in the second volume of Jung in the 21st Century in which I talk about some of the ways in which biology is reaching for what seems to be something like a psychoid principle. And there's another chapter in which I try to show that physics seems to be reaching for a psychoid principle. Not all physicists, not all biologists to be sure, but some of the things that have received a good deal of notice in recent years are seeming to look for explanations for these things. You know, it does seem as though there must be we must have some relationship to the plants around us. You know, so how is it that, take an extreme example, some plants produce psychedelic molecules. Which molecules don't ever help the plant, as far as we can figure out, but mammals love them. So, you know, there's something going on here, you know. And it seems as though the universe is something in which new things are constantly arising because these things can come together so well. So there's a harmony between the stars that are creating all the molecules, for example, and a place like Earth where there's enough gravity to hold us all here, and then the molecules can begin to interact with one another and eventually can appear to live and so forth. All of that stuff suggests an organizing principle. The psychoid principle is an organizing principle. It's the universe is in the business of life. That's the way I would put it. Yes?
John, I'm reaching for something here. So, when you showed the pictures of the development, the child development, and the animal evolution, and those ideas, scientific ideas about that, I felt like there was something missing.
All right.
And I think it comes down to the definition of image. That to me, the definition of image in my work with Jung and active imagination in the body doesn't just relate to visual. It can be visual, it can be...
Yes, I mean, the whole point of that that comparison was that we humans, mothers and babies, parents and babies, caretakers and babies, and primates are intimately engaged with one another, studying one another's facial expressions, studying one another's gestures and one another's cooings to achieve an emotional relationship which goes some distance toward giving the child in the process a secure foundation in life. And so I would say absolutely, image is very important in that whole thing.
But what I'm saying is image to me comes before the visual cue. Image to me also involves the physiological energetic connection from the womb to the mother infant.
Yeah.
And the baby feels the breast, and there are many, many other images that happen before the visual cues come in. So that feels like that's...
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that argument because I'm not exactly sure what you mean by what sound like prior images. The fact is that...
Energetic or sensation,
mm-hmm.
or...
But all of that stuff is involved in what goes on between the mother and the child. Yeah. And of whether the child has had other visual experiences, say, coming from its physiology. Probably so, yeah, but I'm only talking about this mother-child interaction here, which, I mean, so I, yeah, I think it's what's going on there. And I would say this too, we all still have that ability. We all still have a limbic system, and we can read one another's facial gestures, bodily movements, and so on. Some people are terrible at it. Almost all of us are pretty bad at it. And you have to really work at it to be good at it, because it seems like as we went on, at least in the West, we came to think that it didn't have enough evidence. So we're looking for things that have more evidence. We're caught in this sort of materialistic scientific paradigm, which has its limitations.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the way that your books and your research might have to do with finding one's personal myth? And can you share anything about your own personal myth?
I suppose I could go on for hours talking about what my own personal myth would be, but the fact that I did a speech like this one today probably indicates that this microcosm, macrocosm thing has got to be big in my personal myth. And if you look at the books that I wrote about five of them have been about relationship, erotic relationships, and others. And so I would say that what goes on between two people reveals something about the microcosm, which is mirrored also in the macrocosm. That all of that, there's some, my personal myth would somehow have to do with all of those things, but I'm not sure I could just sit down and spell it out for you. But there's no doubt that the fact that I write these things happens because I get seized by something. Right now, this is an in-between thing. You know, I was asked to talk about Jung in the 21st century, and I came in to do it. But the thing that I've been obsessed with for the last couple of years is Jung was always thinking like an alchemist. And what I'd like to do is to try to show what the alchemists were thinking, the alchemists that Jung was interested in were thinking, and what was going on in those alchemical documents that Jung particularly favored. Because one of the things you'll note is very few of them have anything very much to do with chemical experiments. Many of them never mention the laboratory. The Secret of the Golden Flower, which got him going on this, that it's all about moving the chi around the body in a circle that goes on and on. If you can keep it going for 1,000 cycles, you will reach immortality. Immortality is important in most of them. But that's one. There are many others in which it seems like. The one that Jung searched for years before finding, because he was so interested in it, was Aurora Consurgens. If you read Aurora Consurgens, and it was translated and interpreted by Marie-Louise von Franz as Volume 3 of Jung's Mysterium Conjunctionis, that book is still in print, I believe. And if you read that book, you'll find it very puzzling, because it seems like a disordered collection of quotations from the Bible. Von Franz's interpretation of it is the author was probably Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas is a very, very dry philosopher whose goal it was to sew up everything that was puzzling and incomplete about Christian theology, Catholic theology, actually, and write the book that put it all together and could never be assailed. So while he's working on that, before he quite gets done, he dies, and on his deathbed he says, all is straw. She thinks He knows all his straw because he's had the mystical experiences that he's trying to express in Aurora Consurgens. Aurora Consurgens means dawn arising. It seems to me most of the documents that Jung was interested in, he was interested in them for psychological, mystical reasons. Certainly he wasn't interested in working out what the actual experiments were. That these kinds of things have, a lot of that work has been done in recent years, by the way. There's a whole school of alchemical studies which looks at the documents from the Middle Ages and by various sorts of analysis figures out what chemicals they were using and what results they were getting. Jung was only interested in what they called those chemicals because they were so mythic. That's the piece Jung was interested in. These people think Jung was crazy for talking about the imagery instead of trying to find out what the chemicals were. Well, Jung was interested in the psychology of those people. And I think that some of these examples I just gave are part of it. Yes, Anita.
I'm curious, John, and I may have been off on my own remunerations, but you speak a lot about the moment and describing the biological intentionality of the archetype.
Yes.
What was it you put on the second volume? It looked a bit like a butterfly, but I'm not sure. You didn't mention
I didn't? That. Oh, that was the one in the second volume was the scarab beetle.
Oh, that's the scarab. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Let's give this guy a chance.
I almost want to say ask too much, but I was wanting to know if you knew what the relationships are between gravity field, electromagnetic, and quantum, and synchronicity. And I also want to ask the difference between psyche and self, and the difference between myth and archetype. So I know that's a lot.
Wow. That's a lot. I'm not sure I can answer the questions you asked about that. I think that physicists would not be able to answer those questions either. But, for instance, you said, what's the difference between psyche and self? Well, psyche is anything in us that gives rise to mentality. And I don't mean thinking only, but feeling, emotions, sensations, all of that kind of stuff is part of psyche. But I think for Jung, probably the most important piece is intentionality. He interpreted Freud's libido as being too much sexual, kind of suggesting that the only thing that ever happens in the psyche is sexual. And Jung was saying, what we need to do is see that everything that happens is happening because there's a thrust, a desire, a wanting in the psyche. That's what, you know, Freud's idea of the dream was, it's wish fulfillment. It's because the psyche is always wishing and desiring that we have this thing. So that was, to talk about psyche, it has to have those elements in them. The thinking, sensation, feeling, intuition, and the drive to do something about all that. Self refers to our wholeness. Sometimes Jungians talk about it almost as though it were a point in the middle of the psyche. I think that's overlooking the most important piece. And the most important piece is the self is our wholeness. And we can only know aspects of ourself because our ego is not big enough to contain our wholeness. So there's a sense in which our self is a part of us that is partly psychic and partly psychoid, and is similar to the mental pole, you might say, of the cosmos. I just mentioned a phrase that I think is that's used a lot in Volume 2, the one on synchronicity and science. The philosopher Alfred North Whitehead talked about the fundamental things. He said, we've been wrong to think of them as substance. They're not substance. They're incidents. They are acts. They are occasions. And every occasion has both a physical part and a mental part. a physical pole and a mental pole. And so he would describe, I think, when I describe Jung's cosmos, I'm also describing Whitehead's cosmos. Way in the back there. I'm sorry, this guy's not done yet, I guess.
I was just wanting to see that myth and archetype.
Myth and archetype. Well, myth would be, archetype is smaller than myth. Archetype is seeing mythic significance in something. And I would say myth is, Jung defined myth once as saying that a doctor of the church once said, and he didn't identify who the doctor of the church was, that myth is what is everywhere and always true. It is the fundamental source of truth. I would say it's the source of truth that has a sort of deep quality to it, and a kind of mystical quality to it. It's something that gives meaning to life. In the archetype, we see something that has mythic significance, and it pulls us to do something about that. It's much more, you might say, atomistic than a myth, which is like a whole world.
So from what you said, I hear the psyche is in the center of self, and archetype is in the center of myth.
I would say, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know whether I'm going to buy that, you know, not wrong, but I don't know if I want to commit myself to that. Yeah, way in the back, the purple, yes.
How do you feel about interspecies communication? And that you were talking way in the beginning about the moth.
Yes.
And how it's very limited and sort of reactive to the plant.
Yes.
I had an experience, a personal experience, being communicated to by a butterfly, got two butterflies, where it was, I'm serious.
Yeah, I know you are.
I was taking a walk and there was a dead butterfly with this other butterfly. I'll just tell you the story. And this other butterfly was by its side, trying to lift it up, almost like trying to bring it back to life. And then there was a third butterfly kind of circling around the two of them, very distraught, obviously. And I stood there and I was like, empathizing with what was going on and how they, because I could feel their upset. And the one that was flying around started flying around me, almost like it was saying, please help, please help. And when finally, I just said out loud, I'm sorry, I really wish I could help, but I can't. And then in my mind, this very loud message came, which was, everything feels.
Everything feels?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what they were exhibiting was not only feeling, but intentionality.
Yes.
To me, said that they have sight.
They have, yes. If they have intentionality, that would be the minimum thing required for a psychoid process. Whether they can talk to themselves in images or not would be whether they have a psyche. This is only Jung's definitions. You can throw them out if you like. I'm just saying, in order to understand some of Jung's statements, you have to know how he makes some distinctions. However, you saw something extraordinary, which I would be reluctant to interpret too much. But it's obviously a powerful experience that you had, and it does suggest that there might be some sociality in insects. I didn't mean to deny that, by the way, when I said that the yucca moth, when its archetype of reproduction is stimulated by the yucca flower in bloom, it's only interested in doing that. Yeah, but that there might be other moments in the butterfly's life when it's not reproducing. It might have relations with other butterflies, which is something I hadn't imagined. But it's certainly the case that pretty much all mammals have relations with other mammals and do help one another out and so forth. Yes.
One thing you happen to emphasize that in my work as a therapist comes up over and over again, as well as in my own psychic life, is how often synchronicity occurs in dream experience. And one of the most dramatic examples of this is in Edward Whitmont's book, The Symbolic Quest, where he cites a bishop in wherever it is, where the Archduke Ferdinand came from, on the morning in which the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated later in the day, the bishop awoke with a terrifying dream. And in the dream, he saw the Archduke and his wife being driven in a carriage, and a man came out of the crowd and shot them both. And he was so disturbed by it that he called in witnesses to his, to tell his dream, and it was written down. And within hours, that very thing occurred. So there are premonitory dreams.
Oh, yeah.
And synchronistic dreams. And I think that's one of the areas where we are most in touch with the psychoid and with what I would almost call the right hemisphere of the brain, where the imaginal and the instinctive are predominant. And it demonstrates how our conscious, rational, scientific, materialistic Western mind has been cut off from this dimension, and only sometimes by way of our dreams can we get reconnected.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yes, lots of synchronistic things happen in dreams, absolutely. Yes?
I'm just wondering if you would be willing to do a little conjecturing about Jung in the 22nd century, what he might possibly think about. I keep thinking about merging between humans and cyber material and the search for mentality. Whether or not that's how that kind of fits into, I think I'd stop right there because I can't go past that.
I missed a couple of phrases in there. But I heard something about cyber. And do you mean are you talking about the kind of conversations that are sometimes happening now, where we're wondering whether we're going to be sort of fused with robots? And yeah. Geez, I haven't devoted much thought to that at all. But it seems to me that I find it hard to imagine that a robot could have all of the qualities that we have in terms of moral qualities and sensitivities and so on. But I don't know anything about. I mean, I'm fairly ignorant about such technological things, so I have no idea how to make sense of it. Yes,
you. I can't help but think of your story about the living organisms eating the glass and the seals out on our spaceships.
Yeah.
What is possible?
Yes. Yes. I mean, yeah. In that case, however, it wasn't so much. Something cybernetic. It was, if I'm using that word correctly, it was that earthly microorganisms put in a new environment find a way to survive in that new environment by undergoing changes in their genes. And my point there was that we are in touch with the environment all the time. And it's very likely that new species arise more quickly than Darwin was ever able to imagine. You know, just think about the great die-offs that have happened on the planet. Usually, something that took maybe 500 million years to evolve, when these things die off, something very much more advanced arises in maybe only 50 million years. So how can it happen so quickly? Because it's building on the survivors of the last die-off, and those survivors, I believe, are responding to the environment they're living in. An anthropologist, whose name I probably won't come up with right now, Jeremy Narby, after having gone to the Amazon to study what a particular group was doing with their land, it was supposed to be about culture and land use, he discovers ayahuasca, and has a few occasions where he's given ayahuasca by a shaman and so forth, and he comes back to Switzerland. He's Swiss. He comes back to Switzerland with the idea that, what am I going to do now? I thought I was a scientist. I was there. I was sent there to study the multiplicity of the world and how it's divided up. And now I find out all is one. And what can I do about that? So he wrote a book entitled The Cosmic Serpent, in which he follows out some of the mythology in these things, but also puts it together with biology, and gives his opinion that our DNA is reading the DNA of everything around us. That DNA actually puts out very low energy photons, and they can be picked up by others. And if that's the case, we are in communication with the vegetable world around us, and also, of course, the animals around us as well. If that were the case, that's something that's kind of psychoid, you know. Here are the elements of the world cooperating together to make new elements, to solve new problems, and doing so by modifying their genes. So, I mean, all of this stuff is seems to me is nicely relatable.
I think that's interesting, and going back to what Erica had said earlier, that image is generally thought of as a visual experience, but when you were talking about the layers of the onion and the psychoid behavior as you get to different organisms, some of those organisms don't have sight, so they have other senses. And mm-hmm. Now you're talking about the possibility that DNA is emitting photons which are detected by the things around them. And now we have a system communicating with itself in images, as well as
right.
The possibility of intentionality, and we start to see psyche everywhere.
Uh-huh. I see what you mean, yes, right. Yeah, by the way, that issue of images is interesting. The word that Jung usually used, that we use word images, Vorstellung. A Vorstellung is merely something put out there before us. And it doesn't have to be, we think of it always as visual, because image in English implies something visual. But I think Jung meant anything from any of the senses is in that Vorstellung. So it's not only images in the visual sense, right? So that I think that actually even amplifies what you just said.
That's nice, because that's been bothering me for a while, the idea that it's limited to, like, because the word image is so strongly used in the English study.
Yes. Yes.
But what about, you know, for instance, blind people, you know, people blind from birth, or anything like that? So what experiences are those? And then that brings up the concept of a non-visual symbol.
Right.
And now it just opens things.
Yeah, it reminds me that I had a student years ago who told me that she was a pianist and she always dreamt in music, which is rather surprising. I always had thought, like yourself, I'd always thought that we dream in images, and never thought that the music itself could be that. And my office mate in the philosophy department had told me that he dreamt only in mathematics because he was the field of philosophy he was in was about speaking in mathematical like sentences. And that's what he dreamt in, he said. And you know, I think that probably what we dream has a lot to do with what we do every day, and that some people are going to have much more visual content in their dreams, and others maybe more sound content or smells or lots of things like that could be part of our dreams. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that during an incident of synchronicity, there's the experience of a resonant field from the micro to the macro, and there's a sense of an echo that comes back in some way, so that there's a kind of wholeness in that moment because there's a resonance.
I don't know what to make of that statement. What is resonating with what?
Well, it feels like there's a resonant field. In a moment of synchronicity, it's as though
if you and I, for instance, have the same thing occur to us in the same moment, we might well feel a sort of a feeling of being related.
And, right. Yeah. Or we might actually be seeing the same image.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
But there is this.
I think it happens a lot with people who are closely in tune with one another.
Right.
Life partners and so on might be imagining very in parallel manners with one another, and then speaking and finding out that, wow, were you thinking of that too? This kind of thing? Yeah.
So the resonant field.
Right, I see, yes.
But
I think field is a good word for that, yeah.
Yeah, another thing that comes with it is when that's experienced, it's as though something else hears in a much bigger way. There's a sense of holding that's bigger than just the familiar.
So not only have I heard your thing,
right,
but somehow the cosmos hears it.
Right. Mm. And so there's a certain, my experience and that of patients is there's a certain comfort in that as opposed to fear.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yes, I mean, you could be scared by what happens synchronistically, but I could see how feeling connected to someone would be a comforting thing. Yeah, Jung actually says, we have absolute knowledge.
That's what I mean.
Which would imply that theoretically we could know anything that's happening in the cosmos at any time, right? My point would be, for the most part, 99.99% of the time, synchronicity happens between people who are emotionally connected with one another. It seems to me emotional connection is very important to most experiences of synchronicity. For example, the patient who shot himself while Jung was in another city, Jung clearly had a close relationship to that guy. He recognized that guy's depression as being distinctly his depression, and he must have had a tremendous affection. And I think we all have a strong affection for our Aunt Lizanne's, and that would have to have been involved too. Yep. All right. Yes. Charlie.
This may be too late in the night, but as I'm looking at your figure there, it seems to me that your horizontal axis is sort of a special case of the Q anchor, and synchronicity is something radically different. Do you have any comment on that?
This is what I would say. The Q, the quantum thing, underlies everything. We just don't know quite how it underlies everything, although we know enough about it that we can make cell phones and computers and all that kind of stuff. So yes, the quantum thing does underlie everything. I would say that the psychoid piece, the synchronistic piece, also underlies everything. And I meant to say that when I said the universe is in the business of life. So it's putting things together. I mean, the fact that there are organic molecules floating around in outer space, for example. Teilhard de Chardin said, think of it this way. Start with the mud of the earth, come up through the water, through the atmosphere, and what you see is in the molecules are down there in the mud and the water are also, some of those molecules are in the air, and some of them are proteins, and these proteins are the atoms trying to find a way to speak. So there's this sense that there's something living emerging always around. I think that is what Jung is pointing to with the synchronistic principle. Okay, have we run out of questions?
This woman has had her hand up for half an
hour. Oh, I'm sorry. By all means. I guess you're...
I was piggybacking on something that Thayer said about right brain, left brain.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the gifts of dementia, which if we live long enough, the more recently acquired parts of our brain start atrophying, and what we're left with in dementia and also in old age is the limbic system, which stays intact even when the other parts of the brain, the more newly acquired parts of the brain, die off. We're left with the limbic system, and it seems to me, as a kind of general systems theory, that because we can retain long-term memory but not short-term memory, that I'm seeing that the human physiological cycle, well, I also actually see it this way, that it is replicating the cycle of the species, and that maybe we are moving closer to a stronger limbic system and a more long-lasting limbic system.
Well, thank you very much for that. I feel like I'm totally unqualified to say anything about it. But you suggested that. I mean, it's sort of mind blowing that you suggested that something like Alzheimer's disease might be a blessing. Because it gives us, we can't help but pay attention to the limbic system. But when the limbic system, I could say, for those of you who don't know that, this is, it evolved in the brain with the earliest mammals. And it's a way of getting an emotional, living in an emotional world. So that everything you see has emotional significance. And it happens very quickly. That we respond emotionally to things, and it's a survival piece for mammals in that they can react emotionally immediately without having to think about it or remember anything. It's all done automatically by the limbic system. Yeah, and so what she seems to be suggesting is we can get carried away with what our higher brain is doing, but there's something. Even there's something of tremendous significance that has to do with relationship and emotional connection that's in the limbic brain, and maybe what else Alzheimer's is trying to get us to do is to pay attention to this other piece. I think. Did I get our message right, or garble it too much?
Yeah, and because when people have dementia and they lose the other mentation functions that are more recently acquired, people become emotionally available, both in terms of fear and panic and fight and flight and all that, but also emotionally available in terms of just feelings, being able to relate out of their feelings, including even hallucinations, which are kind of waking dreams. So, to me, dementia is a tremendous gift because people with dementia are emotionally much more available, and I'm positing that maybe as we see people growing older and older and moving in that direction, in the dementia direction, that maybe the species is also moving in that direction.
Okay, maybe. Do you work with Alzheimer's patients?
I work with dementia patients.
Okay. All right, so, and because the reason I ask is, well, I come from a family that pretty much all succumbs to Alzheimer's on one side.
All evolved into it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm, and I also have people who are seeing me as Anna Lizanne's who are volunteering with dementia patients. And I haven't heard anything like that from anybody else. But I will certainly pay attention to what you just said because I think it's it gives a sense of hopefulness and broader meaning to something that up to now we've only been able to see as a tragedy. Yeah. Okay, I think that's a good note on which to...